At dawn, Hunt and Trona were skidding across the Sea of Cortez in a panga, both holding their hats in their hands, spray flying and the red paint of sunrise spread out before them. Saralvo Island was a gray behemoth in the distance. The captain was named Israel, and his panga was Luna Sombrero. He said little and regarded the anglers skeptically. Hunt shot pictures left and right, swung the camera, and before he could think, he'd shot Trona not once, but twice. As Hunt slid the camera back into one of the many pockets of his fishing shirt, he felt embarrassed for barging into Joe's face like that, then saw the minor joy on it, the joy that a cursed childhood could not prevent, the joy of being on the water. Two boys raised by adoptive parents go fishing, thought Hunt. What a cool thing. As the Yamaha screamed along, Hunt saw Israel turn to Joe, take his hands off the wheel, and swing an invisible baseball bat. Nice form. Buster Posey-ish. Beside him, Trona gave the captain a thumbs up and a smile appeared beneath Israel's sunglasses. What's up? Hunt asked. Baseball. The captains all play. Israel says there's a game tonight. It's quality ball if you want to go. Done. The water shone pale, flat, and nacreous in the early day, the sun barely a foot off the horizon. Already Hunt could feel its heat and could only imagine what it would be like when it reached its zenith. Suddenly, Israel swung the wheel and the panga pitched hard left, heading into a cove along the shoreline where another small boat, now just visible, had anchored. Behind them, the other fishermen from Joe's fell in line, and within 5 minutes they were all floating around the bait boat. Hunt wasn't expecting bait, and with all of his new flies, why would he? But bait seemed to be part of the ritual here. Whatever its purpose, he'd soon find it out. Once everybody had loaded up with sardines, the captains held a short conference, and then they were off again away from the shore and out over the vast expanse of water. With Israel leading the way and nothing even remotely like a GPS, they were all heading toward a destination that must have been clear to them, although Hunt couldn't make out any kind of a marker or buoy. The target, a good 10 minutes and perhaps a mile out, was a white 1 gallon plastic Clorox container, tied to some rope that probably had a sea anchor attached down below to keep it more or less in place. Hunt thought that Israel locating this random piece of flotsam out in the endless, unbroken surface of water, a fairly impressive feat of navigation. "Fish here?" he asked. "Shade," Trona said. "A little goes a long way." Meanwhile, the captain had cut the motor, and now Trona grabbed his rod and stepped up, taking the more precarious position on the bow. "Showtime," he said, playing line out at his feet. At his place in the middle of the panga, Hunt stood and started doing the same as Israel threw a couple of pieces of bait out into the water around them. Nothing. They waited. There was no swell, and after a minute or so, the light chop of the other pangas had dissipated as well, and it was dead still. Hunt, tensed for action, dared a look around at the other four parties who'd killed their own engines and fallen into a semicircle behind them. Suddenly, though, Israel leaned forward and slapped a heavy palm on Hunt's shoulder. "Hey, hey!" pointing into the well of the boat at Hunt's feet. Hunt turned back, looked down, saw nothing. "What?" he asked, then over to Trona. "What's he want?" Trona risked a quick glance over. "You're standing on your line," he said. Hunt backed up off it. Israel leaned over and tossed a 5 gallon plastic bucket up to Hunt's spot. "Put your line in that," Trona said. "Keeps it out of the way. Don't let it wrap around your leg, or your hand for that matter, and especially your fingers. 100-pound tuna hits in your fingers wrapped with 80-pound, it'll amputate right then." Hunt got himself squared away. Israel threw another couple sardines out into the clear, blue, still water. Trona scanned the horizon in a wide arc. Then a sudden swirl at the surface out in front of Hunt, and Israel came alive.
Dorado, dorado!
Hunt got his rod up, pumped, cast, fed line, back cast, waiting what seemed interminably for the rod to load as he'd been taught, then let it rip again. This time the instant that the fly landed, one of the big fish struck. He'd never really imagined anything like this kind of acceleration in any fishing context. Suddenly, just about immediately, all the line that he'd so carefully dropped into his plastic bucket, 50 or 60 feet of it, was gone, and now he was onto his reel, already nearly to the backing, holding on for all he was worth with one hand as the reel spun beneath his other palm and the running fish ran off yard upon yard and then, 60 or 70 yards out, jumped once, twice, a third time. Unable to stop himself or even aware of it, he let out a scream.
Hee-yah!
You got him, Trona said. Let him run. Stay cool. You got him. After the fishing and a brief siesta back at the hotel, Joe borrowed Baja Joe's van and drove to Los Planes to see the baseball game. Over the years, he'd become a fan. The boat captains were all good players, and Israel's tiny village of Agua Amarga was pitted against mighty La Paz. Hunt rode along. As soon as the sun went down and the heat dropped slightly, the game started under sparse lights, before a big and boisterous crowd. Israel was on the mound, carefully picking his way through La Paz's heavy hitters. Trona and Hunt drank Pacificos and ate spicy peanuts, compared California's new austerity to the poverty they saw here. Hunt noted that either one could produce fine baseball. Joe waved to Israel's sister Angelica, sitting just a few rows down with three of Israel's four children. No sign of Israel's wife or oldest son. Joe felt the burn on the back of his neck, something no amount of sunscreen could prevent here in Baja. But it was a good feeling, and he felt his heart downshift. Halfway through the third, a fleet of four black SUVs came tearing across the flat, dusty desert from far away, hopping over the creosote bushes and dunes, converging from all the outfield directions. The field they were playing on here had no home run fence, and so nothing stood between these intruders and the players. Murmurs rose. Then tense voices rippled through the crowd, and some of the spectators clambered down the bleachers, heading for where they had haphazardly parked. Israel stood in an alert posture on the mound, watching. Trona saw no emblems or roof lights or radio antennae on the SUVs. I don't think they're fans, said Hunt. Oh, they're not. I left my bazooka at home. Joe felt for the 45 that was not on his hip, the 40 that was not on his ankle, then finally the 44 Derringer that was not in his pant pocket, and thought, Mexican law is Mexican law, gringo law enforcement or not. The SUVs slid to dusty stops one by one and disgorged cumbersome, heavily armed men. Trona saw the Zetas, patches on their shoulders, and his heart went cold. He and Hunt had joined the crowd surging down the stands, then ducked under one of the bleacher benches, and like monkeys lowered themselves to the ground. Joe peered through the scaffolding and saw Israel still on the mound, waiting for four Zetas who strode toward him from center field. Their M16s shone dully in the lights, and the outfielders stood frozen, watching them with what might have been resignation or terror. Everywhere Joe looked, he saw another fire squad of Zetas closing in, nine men in all, a baseball team's worth of armed men. Fans hustled through the dust of the parking area, children scampering out ahead, car doors opening and slamming shut. At the mound, the four Zetas surrounded Israel. One of them motioned with his gun, and Joe could see that Israel and the man were talking, and that Israel was nodding his head in agreement. The other five Zetas came trotting in from across left field, straight in Joe's direction. He had been in a situation like this before, many years ago, and he had killed several men, but failed to protect the man he had pledged his life to protect. Something touched the back of his arm, and he reeled to find Angelica and Israel's three small children behind him.
"That man is Hector," said Angelica. "He left Agua Amarga 5 years ago to be a Zeta. He wants to be known for his cruelty. Now Hector has come for him."
"For Israel?" She shook her head no.
"For his son, Joaquin," she said. "Joaquin comes to the games, but not to this one."
The five Zetas were nearly to second base now, and still coming directly toward Trona and Hunt, and Angelica and Israel's children.
"Joe," said Hunt,
"time to move it."
"When they don't find Joaquin here, they go to Agua Amarga. They know."
Joe took Angelica's hand and crouched and led her and the children away from home plate and the refreshment stand and the parking lot. Wyatt brought up the rear. Where the grandstands ended, they stopped and huddled, half hidden from the stadium lights and the scaffolding. Automatic gunfire burped from the parking lot and screams rose in the sudden silence. Some of the parking lights burst and smoked. Laughter. Then more shots and more lights exploded. Trona saw Israel on the mound, still and tensed, searching the bleachers for his sister and children. Three of the gunmen, the ones who'd been with Hector at the mound, had taken up positions at second base, shortstop, and first, but hadn't let go of their guns. Hector strode dramatically to home plate and set his machine gun in the on-deck circle. He lifted the bat that the last La Paz hitter had left behind and took a couple of check swings, then walked to the plate and stepped into the batter's box. By now, the five oncoming narcotraficantes were methodically searching the grandstands where Angelica and the children had been sitting just moments ago. Israel wound up and slung a slow ball, and Hector drove it to left center for a single. Hector dropped the bat and raised his hands over his head as if he'd just homered. Israel backpedaled toward the chaos, his glove and free hand raised to the Zetas in supplication. The leader yelled to his men, waving the bat at them, and Trona saw Israel disappear around the dugout.
"When they are finished having fun, they will go to Agua Amarga and find Joaquin," said Angelica. "And it will no longer be fun."
Trona looked at Hunt, and Hunt looked at Trona. "Something tells me we should get there first," said Hunt. Staying low and in the darkness, they guided Angelica and the children to the borrowed van. Trona drove through the dark without lights, blended into the cars heading for the road. Then they hit the highway a few minutes later.
"Why do they want Joaquin?" asked Joe. "He's only, what, 15?
Angelica steadfastly ignored him. Trona asked again, and she turned to him, her frightened expression lit faintly by the dash lights.
"Joaquin found gold in the hills, in one of the old mines. They are everywhere, and the boys are always digging and searching. The gold belongs to the village. We are going to use it to make our old pangas more safer and buy a new Yamaha engine for Gordo, and to buy a truck for Luis because his truck is dying. And we were going to send Maria Hidalgo Lucero to school in La Paz because she is a smart one, and buy a new generator and a freezer for Agua Amarga to share, one with a very good ice maker. And then when we ran out of gold, Joaquin and the boys would go to find more in this mine, and we would improve Agua Amarga with the gold forever. But Joaquin cannot keep quiet. His word spread like a fire. Now Hector knows. He will take the gold, and he will force Joaquin to expose the mine. Maybe worse."
Angelica pointed to a shortcut to Agua Amarga, and Joe slowed and steered the van off the highway and onto a narrow dirt road. "Two of us and a few village men can't keep Hector from taking the gold," said Joe.
"I just got an idea," said Hunt.
"Maybe not a full idea, part of one."
"I did too," said Trona.
Like all of his neighbors' homes, Israel's was one-story whitewashed stucco. Strands of rebar poked up from the roofline, announcing to the government that construction was not complete. Therefore, the house was not finished, therefore, it couldn't yet be taxed.
The house squatted by itself at the end of a dirt road just at the edge of Agua Amarga. Behind it, a vast wasteland of cactus and shrub, laced with half a dozen or more dry arroyos, stretched to a low range of foothills off in the distance, the shape of the range clearly visible now in the light of the full moon. The house itself seemed to sit in a pale glow from the bare bulb over the front door. The four SUVs skidded to their own ostentatious stops in front of the house, dust billowing up around them. Before much of that dust had settled, the passenger's door on the lead car opened, and a man emerged, cradling a machine gun. When he pulled open the back door behind him, a body in a baseball uniform got pushed from inside and fell into the road. Israel. The Zeta kicked out once and the body rolled away, hands coming up over the head for protection. Israel rolled over a second time and suddenly was on his feet, facing his assailant, turning halfway to face the other Zeta just coming out of the car. But the other car doors were opening all around, other men spilling out. Headlights from each of the vehicles stayed on, illuminating the scene. Israel was surrounded with nowhere to turn when the front door of the SUV he'd come in opened and Hector got out.
Basta!
The leader called out, and all around the men stiffened to something like attention as he came around the front of his SUV. In Spanish, Hector continued,
Israel and I will talk. He is a reasonable man.
Israel spit at the ground. Hector got alongside the Zeta who'd kicked at their captive and now made a command gesture. Without a word, the Zeta handed his machine gun to Hector, who paused for an instant and then fired off a quick burst of three shots into the spot near Israel's feet where he'd spit. Israel jumped backward at the same moment as a woman's scream rent the air. The front door opened and the screen slammed up against the house, and Angelica was suddenly standing under the light, holding her hands up against her chest in panic. Hector turned around slowly, unfazed by the woman's presence or her reaction. He nodded nonchalantly at Angelica, then came back to Israel.
Where is Joaquin? He asked in a gentle voice.
He is inside. The gold is a lie. It is a tale told by a child. There is no gold.
Why don't you invite me in and we can talk?
Where is your hospitality?
No, said Angelica.
He will come in anyway, said Israel. Let Joaquin tell him that the gold is a lie.
Trona and Hunt watched from the place they'd chosen to hide, behind the abandoned chassis of an old American car that someone had dumped on the side of the road and left on Israel's street about 150 feet from the front door of his home. Their shortcut across the desert in Baja Joe's van had given them a 10 or 12 minute edge over the Zetas, who had driven the long way around on the regular highway. It was all the time they were going to have to get the details of their plan worked out, but it was going to have to be enough. There weren't, as it turned out, too many details to consider. There was one gun, a Colt 45 six-shooter with bullets that might or might not fire, that Israel kept hidden in a cutout floorboard under the bed. A 34-inch Louisville slugger that one of Israel's screwballs had long ago, when he'd been a teenager, broken off in the hands of Fernando Valenzuela. A bottle of Herradura. Now, when Hector and his number one bodyguard disappeared into the house behind Angelica and Israel, Hunt whispered, "So far, so good." One by one, in short order, the Zetas killed their engines and their headlights, until the only light on the street beyond the moons was the one above Israel's door. The seven remaining Zetas broke off into their respective cars, 3, 2, and 2. A couple of them lit up cigarettes. All of them put their weapons down on their car seats. Hunt gave Trona a solemn nod, and the two men stood up, and the solemnity vanished as they lurched drunkenly out into the street. Trona had his arm thrown over Hunt's shoulder. Hunt let out a laugh. He was using the slugger for a cane, nearly stumbling with every step while Trona held the tequila bottle in his free hand, and Hunt broke into a slurred version of Tequila Sunrise. They advanced on the Zetas, a couple of drunk American idiots. The seven congealed again out of their cars, but only two of them brought their weapons out with them. Hunt saw that nobody seemed too concerned with this interruption. It was clear to them what was going on, by no means an uncommon occurrence. Cheap tequila and gringos on vacation were a staple of the economy down here. The Zetas had business they were attending to, and these guys were an interruption, but they certainly weren't anything to worry about. One of the Zetas gave some kind of order, and the two guys who had pulled out their weapons split away from the group and started moving toward the gringos, shooing their hands in front of themselves as though they were trying to move cattle. Shoo away, thought Hunt. Happily drunk and oblivious, Hunt and Trona kept coming, singing along, closing to 100 feet, 75, 60. The lead Zeta held up his weapon, stopping in the road, and said, "Alto, ahora alto." Hunt and Trona, swaying against each other, stopped and blinked at the apparition. Hunt laughed and Trona slurred,
"Sorry, dudes, no habla español, por favor."
Hunt watched the Zetas turn back to their compadres, no doubt wondering what they were supposed to do with these clowns. A couple more of the narcos, who had stayed back by the cars, decided to come on up and help get these pests out of the way, not bothering to bring their weapons. In front of them, Hunt pointed at the machine guns, held up a hand as if he suddenly understood. At the same moment, Trona offered a sip from his bottle of tequila, an excuse to get half a step closer, let the advancing guys get within range. "And," he said, slowly, evenly dragging it out, "now." Hunt came up with the baseball bat and drilled the nearest Zeta over the ear. At the same moment, Trona swung with the tequila bottle in one hand, cold cocking the guy in front of him, drawing the revolver out from his belt with the other, getting the dead drop on the two backup guys. "Don't move, hands up, don't move." Hunt, never slowing down, had his hands on the guy's machine gun before he'd even hit the ground, and now charged the remaining three guards down by the SUVs, who barely had had time to get halfway to their feet, scrambling when they were all looking at a suddenly very serious American commando who was clearly well-trained in the use of the M16 and prepared to use it. They raised their hands, signaling their surrender, as Trona, now armed with his own machine gun and a good handgun, came forward with the other two captives, their arms in the air as well. The gringo's two victims lay bleeding, quiet, unmoving, both face down in the street. Trona stood guard as Hunt collected the rest of the weapons. Minutes later, they had bound and gagged the narcos with duct tape and 50-pound test fishing line that they found in the toolbox of the van, line that would cut them deeply if they struggled. Inside, for Hector, the negotiations were not proceeding well. He'd been a villager here all his life until a few years ago, before accepting the uniform and the dark soul of a Zeta. So he knew how stubborn these people could be, how superstitious, ignorant fishermen. Even pointing his gold-plated Malverde embossed .45 at Joaquin, it had taken Hector a full 10 minutes to convince Israel of the futility of his and the town's position. If there was gold in Agua Amarga, then it was Zeta gold. Hector's gold, verdad? The town was only still in existence because of the forbearance of Hector Salida. Didn't Israel realize that Hector could kill every man, woman, and child in Agua Amarga and nothing would happen? Nobody would care. The useless and corrupt government would do nothing. To oppose Hector would be certain death. Did Israel want to see him kill Joaquin right now in front of him, or did he want to bring him the gold? It was really that simple. Hector looked down at Joaquin, a handsome young man, now curled tight on the floor, trembling like a cold dog. Hector swirled the barrel of his fancy gun through Joaquin's lush black hair. Israel looked at his son, then at Hector, then at Angelica.
"No," she said.
"Yes," said Israel. Hector watched Israel rise and motion to his bodyguard to follow. They went down the hallway of the small house.
Hector heard a scraping sound like furniture being moved. He smiled at Angelica.
I miss the village.
The village does not miss you.
I'd rather be a legend than a slave.
You are a slave to greed.
The two men were back in a moment, the bodyguard swinging a heavy rice bag onto the table, Israel looking on with a beaten expression. Hector swung his weapon away from Joaquin and ordered him to stand. The boy stood on shaking legs, and Hector pointed the barrel of his gun at the bag. Joaquin untied and upended it, and the heavy treasure thundered onto the old wooden table. Hector set his gun down and pawed through his bounty, somewhere near 30 kilograms of quartz run through with thick, visible veins of gold. 5, 8, perhaps 10 kilograms of the gold itself. A fortune. Finally, thought Hector, things are going my way.
Now, where is the mine?
Which mine?
Hector saw Joaquin hang his head and cast a look at his father.
You have 10 seconds to tell me the mine, or I shoot your mother, said Hector.
He pushed the end of the barrel between Angelica's breasts.
1, 2, 3.
Father.
4, 5.
Yes, son, tell him.
6, 7, 8.
Father.
Tell him.
9.
Test pit 96, said Joaquin. On the way to San Antonio.
That is government property, bellowed Hector.
How did you steal gold from the government?
How?
Joaquin looked at his father again imploringly, and Israel nodded.
I have a friend in the ministry, said Joaquin. He knows I steal. We share.
His name?
If I tell you, he will kill me. If I don't, you will.
I feel such sadness.
His name?
Narciso Rueda, muttered Joaquin. God help me.
Someone knocked on the front door. Hector and the bodyguard swung their guns toward the sound. Hunt stood way aside from the door, flat against the wall, and waited for the bullets to punch through. He mustered his best Spanish accent.
Hector, policía, vamos!
The door cracked open and the bodyguard peered out. Hunt grabbed his neck and twisted him back inside just as Hector raised his gun and fired. He felt the heavy .45s thudding into the Zeta's armor, the powerful shockwaves transferring from the bodyguard straight into himself. He threw the man to the floor as Israel crashed down on Hector's arms with a chair, his golden gun skidding across the floor, and Angelica walloped him over the head with a cast-iron tortilla press. Trona burst in from behind them with one of the Zeta's good semi-automatics held straight at Hector, who was back up on his knees, barely. Hunt grabbed the golden gun, then drew his own borrowed handgun from his belt and gave the bodyguard a sharp rap to the head with it. He ordered the family to raise their hands and move back against the wall.
Now!
Joe stepped in and herded them. Angelica raised her hands and looked at Trona.
The devil himself, look at his face.
How nice of you to notice, said Joe, unfailingly polite. I've heard much worse.
Get out of my house, said Israel.
You gringo pigs, leave us alone, yelled Joaquin.
Leave you alone? Asked Hunt. After all your father's talk on the boat radio today? All that fast Spanish he thought we couldn't hear? After his endless bragging about his son finding the gold that was going to bring miracles to Agua Amarga? Leave you alone? Hunt saw Israel's pitch-perfect expression of shame, of foolishness confessed, of utter defeat.
So, said Trona, thanks for the tip, Captain. There's no way we could pass up an opportunity to rob you. But since this hombre beat us to it, we'll just rob him.
¿Le gusta? ¿Es bueno?
Trona, eyes now on Hector and gun still in hand, swept the gold ore back into the rice bag and slung it over his shoulder.
I vow to take back my gold and murder you, said Hector.
We'd have been disappointed if you didn't, said Joe.
Let's go, partner, said Hunt.
Let's tie everybody up first, Trona said.
just for the hell of it.
They had an early plane, 9 a.m., out of La Paz Airport, but both men felt it couldn't really be too early. As they watched and waited for their nearly twin duffel bags to pass through the X-ray machine, Hunt said, "All I want is to get past the security gate. I don't think they'll storm the airport." Trona shrugged. "They're still tied up. Israel not as tight as some, that's all. And Hector and his boys? Who's going to cut them free, the villagers?" "I hope you're right." "And don't get me wrong," Trona said. "I'm keeping my eyes open." He lowered his voice. "I just hope nobody notices we're not boarding with any gold, which might make somebody wonder where it could be." "Who's going to notice? It's not like Hector's going to go to the cops. Hey, those two gringos just stole the gold that I just stole." "I don't think so. Instead, we just walk on the plane and stay cool. As far as Hector's concerned, we got clean away and the gold with us. And he'd never believe that we put it back in Israel's panga." "I know. Although he has vowed to take back his gold and kill us, remember?" Hunt broke a smile and shook his head. "Not gonna happen. Just like he's not going to find any gold in Test Pit 96. With only the 10 minutes or so they'd had to go over their plan with Israel's sister, they'd had to play things by ear. When they'd arrived at Israel's home, for example, first thing they'd had to contend with was a very distrustful and hostile Joaquin and his 15 years' worth of testosterone. Why should he believe that Hunt and Trona were going to steal the gold from Hector and then return it to Israel and the good people of Agua Amarga? How could Angelica believe or trust these two gringos whom she had just met? Who were they, anyway? It had been a close thing, Joaquin getting the colt from its hiding place, only to hold it on Joe and Wyatt for a tense few moments until Angelica could convince him that they really had no other choice. Hector and his narcos would be there within minutes. If Hunt and Trona were in fact planning on stealing the gold and keeping it for themselves, there was nothing Joaquin or anyone else could do about it.
"We could kill them right now, and then kill as many of Hector's men as we could before they kill us," Joaquin said.
"We know that there is more gold in the ground," Angelica had said. "No one needs to die over the gold we already have."
And in the end, only 2 or 3 minutes before Hector and his men had arrived, Joaquin had given in. And still, there had been one element of the plan that had worried Joe. They had no provision for Hector's return to claim the rest of the gold from Joaquin's secret mine. Everyone knew that Hector would not rest until he knew where Joaquin had found the gold, and even if Hunt and Trona were successful in keeping the town's gold from him that night, Hector would eventually cause more trouble when he came again.
"He's going to need to know where you found it," Trona had said, "and he will torture you until you tell him. So there's only one thing to do."
"What is that?"
"Tell him the wrong mine," Joe said, "and sting him."
"Sting him how?"
"Well, that's for you and your father to figure out."
Four days after Hunt and Trona had landed safely back in the States, Narciso Rueda, a longtime angling customer of Israel's, sat in the bow of the panga about 100 meters offshore. He was awaiting the long run-up at full power into ever more and more shallow water until Israel, with perfect timing, lifted the screaming, whining propeller up out of the water and killed the engine as the water became the beach and the panga sheared its way through the sand until it came to rest 20 or 30 feet up onto the strand, high and dry. No matter how many fish they caught, and today Narciso had landed 2 dorado and 2 tuna, the beaching of the pangas always provided an adrenaline rush, a last moment of excitement and pure, simple fun. But today, though they were in position to rush the shore, Israel kept the engine in neutral. Narciso was, in fact, head of security for the government's gold mining operations near La Paz. He had, of course, never made any kind of gold deal with Israel's son. In fact, he was widely known as an incorruptible official. Unlike so many of Mexico's security forces, especially those dealing with the narcotraficantes, Narciso had successfully investigated and prosecuted both gold thieves from among the miners and corruption at the corporate level. No fewer than 24 men now sat in federal prisons because of Narciso's efforts. After he listened to Israel's story, a smile played at the corners of his mouth.
I have heard something of this Hector Salida. A nasty piece of work.
He thinks he can bribe me?
Israel nodded.
I took him out of Saravo last week, he lied. He has a reckless mouth, and he has heard of gold in one of the abandoned mines, gold that supposedly you don't know of.
This made Narciso laugh. Ah, that gold.
And I let him mine that vein and turn the other way, for a cut. That's the idea?
It's what he bragged about.
You might be expecting him to contact you.
I look forward to the conversation, which I'll be certain to record. He is not the first one to have this idea, and our judges have found such recordings to be persuasive. I just thought you would want to know.
Narciso nodded. It is always good to have knowledge.
It keeps the vermin down.
Steve Barry versus James Rollins. In his 2006 thriller, Black Order, Jim Rollins dispatched his hero, Gray Pierce, to Denmark. While there, Pierce spent 2 days visiting the dusty bookshops and antiquary establishments in the narrow back streets of Copenhagen. He discovered the most help at a shop on Højbro Plads, owned by an ex-lawyer from Georgia. No name. Just enough information that, if you were a fan of Steve Barry's hero, Cotton Malone, you know instantly who Pierce was talking about. Jim's purpose was to see if readers were paying attention and could discover the extent of crossover between his and Steve's work. He learned things on both counts. Readers definitely noticed. Jim and Steve together received several thousand emails, and still do to this day. When Steve reciprocated and included a reference to Sigma Force, Jim's clandestine agency where Grace Pierce works, in his next novel, people noticed again. Together, they continued the experiment for several more books. Eventually, fellow thriller writer Raymond Corey, who's part of this anthology, joined the mix. It was fun, but it also alerted the writers to the fact that their readers wanted to see the characters together. That wasn't possible until the opportunity provided by this anthology. There are a lot of similarities between Malone and Pierce. Both are ex-military, single, with issues. They each work for a covert government agency. Pierce with Sigma through the Defense Department. Malone, though now retired, freelances with his former employer, Magellan Billet, at Justice. And where Pierce deals more with science and a little history, Malone focuses on history with a touch of science. Steve came up with a broad idea of something in South America on the Amazon. Jim took that thought and wrote a first draft of the entire story. Steve then revamped that draft, which Jim gave a final edit. The result is about 3 hours in the lives of Gray Pierce and Cop Malone, on a riverboat in the middle of nowhere. Everything happens fast. Nothing atypical for these two.
The Devil's Bones. Commander Gray Pierce stood on the balcony of his suite aboard the luxury riverboat and took stock of his surroundings. Time to get the show on the road. He was 2 days upriver from Belém, the Brazilian port city that served as the gateway to the Amazon, 1 hour from the boat's last stop at a bustling river village. The ship was headed for Manaus, a township deep in the rainforest where the target was supposed to meet his buyers, which Pierce could not allow to happen. The long riverboat, the MV Fawcett, glided along the black waterway, its surface mirroring the surrounding jungle. From the forest, howler monkeys screamed at its passage. Scarlet and gold flashes fluttering through shadowy branches marked the flight of parrots and macaws. Twilight in the jungle was approaching, and fishing bats were already hunting under the overhanging bowers, diving and darting among a tangle of black roots, forcing frogs from their roosts, the soft plops of their bodies into the water announcing a strategic retreat. He wondered what Seichon was doing. He'd left her in Rio de Janeiro, his last sight of her as she donned a pair of khaki shorts and a black t-shirt, not bothering with a bra. Fine by him. Less the better on her. He'd watched as she tugged on her boots, how the cascade of dark hair brushed against her cheeks and shrouded her emerald eyes. He'd found himself thinking about her more and more of late, which was both good and bad. A ringing echoed throughout the boat. Dinner bell. He checked his watch. The meal would begin in 10 minutes and usually lasted an hour. He'd have to be in and out of the room before his target finished eating. He checked the knot on the rope he'd tied to the rail and tossed the line over the side. He'd cut just enough length to reach the balcony directly below, which led into the suite belonging to his target. Edward Trask, an ethnobotanist from Oxford University. Pierce had been provided a full dossier. The 32-year-old researcher disappeared into the Brazilian jungle 3 years ago, only to return 5 months back, sunburnt and gaunt, with a tale of adventures, deprivation, lost tribes, and enlightenment. He became an instant celebrity, his rugged face gracing the pages of Time and Rolling Stone. His British accent and charming self-deprecation seemed crafted for television, and he'd appeared on a slew of national programs, from Good Morning America to The Daily Show. He quickly sold his story to a New York publisher for 7 figures. But one aspect of Trask's story would never see print, a detail uncovered a week ago. Trask was a fraud, and a dangerous one at that. Pierce gripped the rope and quickly shimmied down. He found the balcony below and climbed on, seizing a position to one side of the glass doors. He peered through the parted curtain and tested the door. Unlocked. He eased the panel open and slipped inside the cabin. The layout was identical to his suite above, except Trask seemed a slob. Discarded clothes were piled all over the floor. Wet towels lay scattered on an unmade bed. The remains of some meal cluttered the table. The one saving grace? It wouldn't be hard to hide his search. First, he'd check the obvious, the room safe, but he had to be quiet so as not to alert the guard posted outside. That security measure had necessitated his improvised point of entry. He found the safe in the bedroom closet and slipped a key card, wired to an electronic decoder, into the release mechanism. He'd already calibrated the unit on the safe in his cabin. The combination was found and the lock opened, but the safe contained only Trask's wallet, some cash, and a passport, none of which he was after. He closed the safe and began a systematic examination of the room's hidden corners and cubbies, keeping his movements slow and silent. He'd already reconnoitered his own suite in search of any place that might hide something small, and there were many possibilities. In the bathroom, he checked the hollows beneath the sink, the underside of drawers, the service hatch beneath the whirlpool tub. Nothing. He lingered a moment and surveyed the tight space, making sure he didn't miss anything. The bathroom's marble vanity top seemed a collage of dried toothpaste, balled-up wet tissues, and assorted creams and gels. From his observations over the past 3 days, he knew Trask only allowed the maid and butler into the room once a day, and even then they were accompanied by the guard, a burly fellow with a shaved scalp and a perpetual scowl. He left the bathroom. The bedroom was next. A loud oomph reverberated from the cabin door, which startled him. He froze. Was Trask back? So soon? What sounded like something heavy slid down the door and thumped to the floor outside. The deadbolt released and the doorknob turned. Crap. He had company. Cotton Malone crouched over the slumped guard. He held a finger to the man's thick neck and ensured the presence of a pulse. Faint, but there. He'd managed to surprise the sentry in a chokehold that took far longer than he had expected. Now that the big man was down, he needed to get him out of the hallway. He'd just arrived on the boat an hour ago at its last stop, so everything was being improvised. Which was fine. He was good at making things up. He opened the door to Trask's cabin and hauled the limp body by the armpits. he noted a shoulder holster under the guard's jacket and quickly relieved the man of his weapon. He'd not had time to secure a sidearm due to the foreshortened nature of this mission. Yesterday, he'd been attending an antiquities auction in Buenos Aires, on the hunt for some rare first editions for his Danish bookshop. Cassiopeia Witt was with him. It was supposed to be a fun trip, some time together in Argentina, sun and beaches. But a call from Stephanie Nell, his old employer at the Magellan Billet, had changed those plans. 5 months ago, Dr. Edward Trask had returned from the Brazilian rainforest after 3 years missing, toting an armful of rare botanical specimens, roots, flowers, leaves, and bark, all for the pharmaceutical company that had funded his journey. He claimed his discoveries held great potential, hope for the next cancer drug, cardiac medicine, or impotency pill. He'd also returned with anecdotal stories for each of his samples, tales supposedly told to him by remote shamans and local tribespeople. Over the intervening months, though, word had seeped from the company that the samples were worthless. Most were nothing new. A researcher for the pharmaceutical firm had privately described the much-publicized bounty best. It was like the bastard just grabbed whatever he could find. To both save face and protect the price of its stock, the company clamped a gag order on its employees and hoped the matter would just go away. But it hadn't. In fact, darker tales reached the U.S. government, as it seemed Trask had not come out of the forest entirely empty-handed. Folded amid his specimens, like a single wheat kernel amid much chaff, lay the real botanical jackpot. A rare flower, still unclassified, of the orchid family, that held an organic neurotoxin 100-fold deadlier than sarin. Talk about a jackpot. Trask had been smart enough to both recognize and appreciate the value of his discovery. He'd analyzed and purified the toxin at a private lab, paid for out of his own pocket, his book deal and television appearances lucrative enough to fund the project. Part P.T. Barnum, part monster, last week Trask had secretly offered his discovery for auction, posting its chemical analysis, its potential, and a demonstration video of a room full of caged chimpanzees, all bleeding from eyes and noses, gasping, then falling dead, the air clogged with a yellow vapor. The infomercial had gained the full attention of terrorist organizations around the world, along with U.S. intelligence services. Malone's old haunt, the Magellan Billet, had been tasked by the White House to stop the sale and retrieve the sample. His mistake had come when he'd mentioned to Stephanie Nell last week, during a casual conversation between old friends, that he and Cassiopeia were headed to Argentina. "The sale will happen in Manaus," Stephanie told him yesterday on the phone. He knew the place. Trask is there with a video crew from the Discovery Channel aboard a luxury riverboat. They're touring the neighboring rainforest and preparing for a television special about his lost years in the jungle. His real purpose for being there, though, is to sell his purified sample. We have to get it from him, and you're the closest asset there. I'm retired. I'll make it worth your while. How will I know if I found it? He asked. It's stored in a small metal case in vials about the size of a deck of cards. I assume you want me to do this alone? Preferably. This is highly classified. Tell Cassiopeia you'll only be gone a few days. Cassiopeia did not like it, but she'd understood Stephanie's condition. Call if you need me had been her last words as he left for the airport. He hauled the guard over the cabin threshold, closed the door, and secured the deadbolt. Time to find those vials. Movement disturbed the silence. He whirled and saw a form in the dim light, raising a weapon. Trask was gone, in the dining room. He'd made sure of that before his assault on the sentry. So who was this? He still held the gun just retrieved from the guard, which he aimed at the threat. "I wouldn't do that," a gruff voice flavored with a slight Texas twang said. He knew that voice. Gray friggin' Pierce. Pierce kept his pistol firmly aimed and recognized the southern drawl. Cotton Malone, how about that? A blast from the past. He took stock of the former agent in the dim light. Mid-40s, still fit, light brown hair with not all that much gray. He knew Malone was retired, living in Copenhagen, owning a rare bookshop. He'd even visited him there once a couple of years ago. There were stories that Malone occasionally moonlighted for his former boss, Stephanie Nell. Malone had been one of her original 12 agents at the Magellan Billet until he opted out early. Pierce knew the unit, highly specialized, worked out of the Justice Department, reported only to the Attorney General and the President. He lowered his gun.
Just what we need, a damn lawyer.
About as bad as having Mr. Wizard on the job, Malone said, lowering his gun, too. Pierce got the connection. Sigma Force, his employer, was part of DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. Sigma comprised a clandestine group of former Special Forces soldiers, retrained in scientific disciplines, who served as field operatives. Where Sigma dealt with lots of science and a little history, the Magellan Billet handled global threats that delved more into history and little science.
Let me guess, he said to Malone. You know about Trask's neurotoxin?
That's what I'm here to get.
Seems we have an interagency failure to communicate. The coaches sent two quarterbacks onto the field.
Nothing new. How about I go back to Buenos Aires and you handle this? Pierce caught the real meaning.
Got a girl there?
That I do. An explosion rocked the boat. From the stern, heaving the hull high, tossing them both against the wall. He tangled with Malone, hitting something solid, but managed to keep hold of his gun. The blast faded, and screams filled the air, echoing throughout the ship. The riverboat listed to starboard.
That ain't good, Malone said as they both regained their balance.
You think? The boat continued to list, tilting farther starboard, confirming the hull was taking on water. A glance past the balcony revealed a pall of black smoke wafting skyward. Something was on fire. A pounding of boots sounded from beyond the cabin door. A shotgun blast tore through the deadbolt and the door crashed open. Both he and Malone swung their guns toward the smoky threshold. Two men barged inside, dressed in paramilitary uniforms, their faces obscured by black scarves. One carried a shotgun, the other an assault rifle. Pierce shot the man with the double barrel while Malone took down the other.
This is interesting, Malone muttered, as Pierce quickly checked the hallway and confirmed only the two gunmen. Seems we're not the only ones looking for Trask's poison. Were you able to find it?
He shook his head.
I only had a chance to search half the suite, but it shouldn't take long to...
Gun blasts popped in the distance. Pierce cocked an ear.
That came from the dining hall.
Our visitors must be going after Trask, Malone said. He could have it on him. Which was a real possibility. He'd already considered that option, which was why he'd gone to great lengths to keep his search of the cabin under the radar. If the effort proved futile, he didn't want to alert Trask and make him extra guarded.
Finish your search here, Malone said. I'll get Trask.
He had no choice. Things were happening fast and off script.
Lawyer or no lawyer, he needed the help.
Do it. Malone raced down the canted passageway, a hand on the wall to keep his balance. He'd not seen Gray Pierce since that day in his bookshop a couple of years ago. He actually liked the guy. There were a lot of similarities between them. Both were former soldiers, both recruited into intelligence services. Each seemed to have taken care of themselves physically. The big difference came with age. Pierce was at least 10 years younger, and that made a difference, particularly in this business. The other contrast was that Pierce was still in the game while Malone was merely an occasional player, and he wasn't foolish enough not to realize that mattered. He skidded to a stop as he approached the stairs that led down to the riverboat's dining hall. Take it slow from here in. Through a window, he surveyed the river outside. The boat sat askew, foundering in the swift current. Past a roil of smoke, he spotted a gunmetal gray craft prowling into view. A uniformed man, whose features were obscured by a wrap of black cloth, stood at its stern, the long tube of a rocket-propelled grenade launcher resting on his shoulder, which was apparently how they'd scuttled the boat.
He rounded the landing and double doors appeared below. A body lay at the threshold in a pool of blood. The man dressed as a maitre d'. He slowed his pace and negotiated the steps with care, approaching the door from one side and snuck a quick peek into the room. More bodies lay strewn among overturned tables and chairs, at least 24. A large clutch of passengers huddled to one side of the spacious room, held at gunpoint by a pair of men. Another 2 men stalked through bodies, searching. One held a photograph, likely looking for someone who matched Trask's face. Amid the captives, Malone spotted the good doctor. Stephanie had provided him an image by email. Trask kept his back to the gunman, hunching into his dinner jacket, a hand half covering his face, trying to be one among many. That ruse wouldn't last long. Trask was strikingly handsome in a roguish way, with unruly auburn hair and sharp planes defining his face. Easy to see how he became a media darling. But those distinct looks should get him flushed out of the crowd and into the assault force's custody in no time. Malone couldn't let that happen. So he bent down and patted his palm into the maitre d's blood. Not the most hygienic thing in the world, but it had to be done. He painted his face with the bloody palm, then slipped the pistol into the waistband of his pants, at the small of his back, and tugged the edge of his shirt over it. Why he did stuff like this, he'd never know. He stumbled into view, limping, holding a bloody hand to his fouled face. "Help me," he called out in a plaintive tone as he wove a path deeper into the room, only to be accosted by one of the gunmen holding the passengers at bay. Orders in Portuguese were barked at him. He feigned surprise and confusion, though he understood every word, a benefit of the eidetic memory that made languages easy for him. He allowed the man to drive him toward the clutch of passengers. He was shoved into the crowd, bouncing off a matronly woman who was held close by her husband. He shifted deeper into the mass, bobbling his way through until he reached Trask's side. Once there, he slipped the pistol out and jabbed it into the botanist's side. "Stay nice and still," he whispered. "I'm here to save your sorry ass." Trask flinched, and it looked like he was about to speak. "Don't talk," he breathed. "I'm your only hope of getting out of here alive, so don't look a gift horse in the mouth." Trask stood still and asked, his lips not moving, "What do you want me to do?" "Where's the biotoxin?" "Get me out of here and I'll bloody well make it worth your while." Typical opportunist, quickly adapting. "I'm not telling you a thing," Trask said, "until you have me somewhere safe." Clearly the guy sensed a momentary advantage. "I could just identify you to these gentlemen," Malone made clear. "I have the vials on me. If even a single one breaks, it'll kill anything and everything within 100 yards. Trust me, there's no stopping it, short of incineration." Trask threw him a glorious smile of victory. "So I suggest you hurry." He took stock of the 4 gunmen. The 2 searchers had about completed their path through the corpses. To better the odds of success, he needed them all grouped together. As he waited for that to happen, he decided to press his own advantage. "Where did you find the orchid?" The doctor gently shook his head. "You'll tell me that much, or I'll shoot my way out of here and leave you to them, making sure I'm 100 yards away fast." Trask clenched his jaw and seemed to get the point. They both continued to stare out at the macabre scene. 6 months into the jungle, I heard a rumor of a plant called Huesos del Diablo, Trask said, keeping his lips still.